Well, good morning, everyone. It is 10 o'clock. I see that we have a very persistent number of people coming along to these hearings, which I'm very pleased to see. Today's will probably be rather, in some ways, a drier session, I think, than on previous days, as we'll be looking at very detailed wordings of the document. But I hope it will prove a stimulating time where we will actually make progress on resolving a certain number of issues. In case there is anyone who hasn't been here on earlier days, I will just make very brief introductions. My name is Peter Rowbottom. Sure, I don't know whether you can read the nameplates, but I am appointed to be the lead examining inspector of this panel. And on my right is Dr. Lillian Harrison, another member of the panel, and further to the right, Professor Austin Smith, the third member of the panel. And in the far right-hand corner is Emery Williams, who is the case manager for the inspectorate on this case. And you may have met Louise Evans, another member of the case team, or you will meet her during the day. She probably is at the back with a roving microphone, but I can't immediately.
In that corner.
All right. Ah, hello, Louise. So that's the team of us who are here today. First of all, may I ask, are there any representatives of the press here? I ask every day, and as it probably becomes further on, there's less likelihood, probably, of them being present, but no response. Thank you. Well, I'll just hand over to Emre to just any other general housekeeping points before we get underway on the agenda, when I'll just have a few more words to say on how I see us proceeding.
Good morning, I'm Emma Williams. As Peter noted, we have the usual suspects, but unfortunately I need to go through these general housekeeping rules. Fire exits, we don't expect any fire drills today, but if there is one, please exit to your left when you get out of this room and meet at the front of the XL, so on the grass embankment. Toilets are situated out the door to your right, past room 6. Mobile phones, could you either turn them off or set them to silent? Again, it does interfere with the recording, so if you hear buzzing noise, it's probably your phone, so you likely have to turn it off. Microphones, please speak directly into them. Provide your name prior to speaking. And then there is Wi-Fi available on this floor, or in this room, should I say, so you can access that free of charge. And then there's copies of the agendas alongside the application documents, which are located in front of the audio team. And then noted yesterday at the break, there was actually a massive queue for coffees and teas. So everyone's aware, besides the lounge area where there's coffee, there's also another room downstairs on the ground floor where you can also go get coffees. So hopefully that will make everything a bit more quicker. And that's it, Peter.
Thank you very much. Well, then, just a few words on how I would hope we might be able to proceed today. It is quite a lengthy agenda, like it has been on the two previous days, but I think we may be able to move reasonably quickly through it if we don't actually try and draft provisions in a development consent order as we go along with a sort of committee of about 20 people. So I would hope that in a sense we might proceed by where there is a difference of opinion as to whether something should be done. Yes, there will have to be submissions and points made there, but where there is an agreement that a change is acceptable and should be made, that then the drafting could be done probably outside of the nature of this examination hearing, and we might then see the fruit of that at hopefully at deadline 3, or if not, if it can't be achieved by deadline 3, at deadline 4, perhaps. So, I say, with that opening approach to how we might look at the proceedings today, I haven't got a great deal more that I'd want to say to start with. The nature of these hearings is all set out in writing on the agendas that I hope everyone has seen. In terms of the item 2 on the agenda, I'm not saying that this needs to be done at great length, and it is my understanding, Mr. Humphreys, that the applicant perhaps wants to say some introductory words on item 3. I would hope that, in a sense, those introductory words on item 3 could be taken within item 2, rather than having a sort of second bite Should I really be addressing my remarks to Mr. Owens this morning?
So I am, but Mr. Owens' assistant today. I offered to carry his bag in, but he politely declined.
Well, Mr. Owen, anyway. So if you want to make some introductory comments on item two, in a sense, if those could be made as part of item two, in sense of way we set out the agenda, we rather thought that the items that highlighted in item three is perhaps some of the most significant changes, and I certainly wasn't expecting under item two for every minutiae of a change to be recounted, but those that are perhaps significant that set the context for where we are today. And so therefore, as I say, if the introduction to three can be part of two, that I think would help us move along. I believe that the Health and Safety Executive have requested that we might take the issue of Grampian conditions or other means of trying to deal with the major hazard issues in relation to Brenntag and the gas holder at an early part in pointing item three, as they have to get to the north of England sometime today. So I hope that will be acceptable before we perhaps deal with the STIG-type issues and some of the other points. So with that, Mr. Owen, then over to you.
Robbie Owen, Transport for London. Thank you, sir, and good morning. Yes, I'm very happy to do that in terms of including in this item two issues that sort of introduce item three as well. Sir, you've asked us to give a brief explanation on behalf of TfL of the changes made to the initial draft of the DCO, both in the revised version submitted at Deadlines 1 and Deadlines 2, and also of any further changes being put forward at today's hearing. Just in that latter respect, I'm sure we will be discussing and contemplating a few changes, but we won't be actually, as you've already suggested, actually putting forward any particular wording for changes today. But deadline three, end of next week, will include a revised draft of the DCO, so revision three, and we will obviously include in that as many further changes as we can of those that come up today. Some may require a bit more cooking, but as many as we can include at deadline three, we will obviously do so. So turning then to the changes to the draft DCO made at deadline one, these are set out in our document REP 1-181. And the changes made to the DCO at that stage arose from ongoing discussions with interested parties, including the host boroughs and the other local authorities. Points raised at the first hearing we had on the DCO on the 12th of October in this room, points you raised in your first written questions, and finally points that we ourselves had identified since submission of the application. I'm not going to go through them all as you've as you mentioned earlier, but I will just highlight the most important ones, I think, for today's purposes. Some definitions in Article 2 were amended. For example, the carve-out in the definition of commencement was reduced in scope. Following discussions with the Port of London Authority, the vertical limited deviation in Article 5 was reduced for works taking place under the riverbed, so for the main tunnel. Further to discussions at the first hearing, the provisions of Article 11 in terms of access to streets from work sites were amended to subject those to street authority approval. In Article 29, which sets out powers of temporary possession of land for carrying out the scheme, the scope of the works able to be constructed on land temporarily occupied was amended for clarity. Turning to Article 38 and scope of the operational powers in the order coming into force at the Blackwall Tunnel, once construction of Silvertown Tunnel starts, that scope was narrowed down following issues raised both by the panel and also interested parties. We then made a number of changes to the user charging policy provisions in conjunction with submitting a revised version of the charging policy document, which was renamed Charging Policies and Procedure Document. And the changes to Article 52, which is the article that secures the charging policy document, were essentially a number of changes to make it quite clear that STIG, the Silvertown Tunnel Implementation Group, would have a key role in terms of at first being consulted by Transport for London in relation to any proposed changes to that charging policy and procedures document, and secondly, when those changes went forward to the Mayor of London for approval, again, the Mayor would consult not just the host boroughs as the drafting had provided previously, but STIG as a whole. So that was the particular change to Article 52, but at the same time, in deadline one, and I'm sure we'll be coming back to this, we did submit the revised and clarified charging policies and procedure document. That's document REP 1-123. In terms of the composition of the Silvertown Tunnel Implementation Group dealt with by Article 65, we did make a few changes there, but deadline one, notably to include the GLA itself as a member of STIG. And perhaps at this opportunity, at this point, I could just make a general point about STIG with reference to item three, really, which is that throughout this process so far, TfL has been listening to the comments made about the role of STIG, its composition, its procedures, how often it would meet, etc., and of course related points made about the TIMS and the monitoring strategy document. Whilst TfL is of the view that the current provisions achieve the project aims and provide enough safeguards, we are continuing to discuss all of these issues with the boroughs to see if any further improvements and additional provisions can sensibly be made. And I should say that to that end, further to all of the comments received from the boroughs over the last 3 or 4 months in relation to STIG, TfL is planning shortly to present some revised proposals for STIG to the boroughs for discussion and hopefully then come back to the examination to present those in due course. And those further proposals, I think, will focus on provisions such as how often STIG meets and its precise way in which it will work. There's currently reference to the voting procedures, etc., and all of those have generated a lot of comment. And suffice it to say that, you know, TfL is listening and taking those seriously and doing a lot of work to see if the procedures for STIG can be improved, because while STIG is proposed to be a consultative body, not a decision-making body, its role is seen as being a very important one by TfL in the overall user charging framework and making sure that the mitigation planned as part of this project is the right mitigation and will be delivered. Moving on to changes to Schedule 2 to the DCO, that's the schedule setting out the requirements, the proposed requirements. Following points made in the first written questions and at the first hearing on the DCO, I think probably the main change is that we reordered Requirement 5, dealing with the Code of Construction Practice and the various plans and strategies that are required to be prepared under that, in some cases for consultation, in other cases for approval, and we will clearly come back to that today, but we certainly feel that is now clearer in terms of what is to be done in fully implementing the Code of Construction Practice by bringing forward those various plans and strategies for consultation and approval. We also added an important requirement 13 in relation to in effect adding a commitment that buses using the tunnel would be Euro 6 compliant. We're clearly going to come back to buses today in terms of how that requirement may need to be further augmented. We also made a few tweaks to the discharge of requirements mechanism in part 2 of Schedule 2 following comments received from the boroughs. Turning to Schedule 13, which sets out various protective provisions for the benefit of statutory bodies, the form of the protective provisions in Schedule 13 for the benefit of the National Grid was amended into the agreed form between the parties. And finally, in relation to Deadline 1 changes, the list of certified documents in Schedule 14 to the DCO was amended following comments made at the first hearing, and also to capture the revised documentation that had by then been submitted at deadline one. That is a summary of the changes made at deadline one. If I can briefly just turn to deadline two with revision two of the DCO. And as set out in our document REP2-033, the changes made in revision to the DCO arose from further discussions with interested parties, including the host boroughs, and points identified by the applicant since submission. Fewer changes were made to the draft at this deadline, it's fair to say. And putting aside drafting and typographical corrections, the main changes I think I would wish to draw the hearing's attention to are these. First of all, we added to membership of STIG in Article 65 the Highways England in respect of its role at the Dartford Crossing. Secondly, Article 58, dealing with the transfer of powers by TfL, that was amended following discussion at the compulsory acquisition hearing in terms of security of funding. We're going to come back to this, I think, today. It's on the agenda. But the provision made was that any proposed exclusive transfer of the order's compulsory acquisition powers would be subject to the Secretary of State approval to the extent that the Secretary of State would have to be satisfied that the proposed recipient of those powers would have sufficient resources to pay the compensation obligations that are attached to them. As I say, we'll come back to that, but that was an important change that we made to Article 58 at Deadline 2. We also made some further tweaks to the requirements in Schedule 2 and some further changes to the list of certified documents in the same manner as I've just outlined in the context of Deadline 1. A final change, which I ought to just highlight to explain it because it takes some explanation, is that we did make an amendment to the protective provisions for the benefit of the Port of London Authority. Now, those protective provisions, as we'll be hearing today, are still not agreed. We're in the course of discussing them with the PLA. We're making good progress on them, but we did at deadline two make a correction to them in terms of paragraph 48 of Schedule 13, and this was for this reason, that an inadvertent consequence of amending the definition of specified work in revision one of the DCO in accordance with our discussions with the PLA. That had resulted in paragraph 48 of Schedule 13 applying to permanent acquisition and permanent works associated with the tunnels, the effect of that being that the National Compensation Code would not apply to the compulsory acquisition of land for those purposes, and instead the rather different compensation regime set out in Section 67 of the Port of London Act 1968 would apply. Now, it was always Transport for London's position that Section 67 should not apply to the tunnels. It is not considered to be the appropriate compensation provision in place of the National Compensation Code, which is considered to be the appropriate provision. So the change we made, in effect, corrects that consequence, with the result that it is now proposed that the Section 67 regime should only apply to temporary possession of land and temporary works. And I'd go further, actually, in terms of the other reason we made the change was that if paragraph 48, in our view, were to apply to the permanent acquisition associated with the tunnels instead of Section 67, therefore, in effect, removing the compensation code from those things, that would not be a lawful provision, given that Section 126(3) of the Planning Act does not allow you in a DCO to exclude what is called a compensation provision, which is a reference to the provision of the compensation code. Now, we are discussing that and many other issues with the Port of London Authority. That change is not yet agreed. I wouldn't wish it to be inferred that it was, but I thought I should just take a bit of time to explain that, because it is it's an important provision in terms of how compensation is assessed for the compulsory acquisition of land for the tunnel. And our position is that it should be under the compensation code, not under the Section 67 separate PLA arrangements, which does provide for a rather different way in which compensation is arrived at. So I hope that assists in terms of a summary of the changes. I could say more, but you probably wouldn't wish that.
No, well, that was very helpful indeed, Mr. Owen. Just to go back to the, in a sense, the introduction you gave to the STIG and related measures that we'll be coming on to shortly, I take it, as you say, that you are hoping shortly to have a meeting with the boroughs. This may be one of those matters where changes can't necessarily be, or at least the totality of the changes can't necessarily be put forward at deadline 3 and might have to be deadline 4, or are you saying that what you're thinking that you would want to achieve you can show at deadline 3, but that may still be subject to discussions and therefore there may be subsequent changes after that?
Robbie Owen, TFL. So I think it's likely to be much more in the realm of deadline 4. These are complex matters involving a lot of interested parties, as you will appreciate, and I think we would like to do our best to achieve more consensus than currently exists in sort of one hit rather than on a sort of drip feed basis. I can't rule out there may be a few changes at deadline 3 that we could put in that would help us get there, but I think fundamentally it's going to take longer than the next 8 days or so that we have.
Thank you very much. Well, I say, if we were... Sorry, that was a cup being raised rather than a Toblerone being erected. Sorry. I think at this point I was expecting to hear from the boroughs, but given the request of the Health and Safety Executive, if we could now perhaps slightly divert, but onto this very important issue of how we're going to deal with the still currently existing major hazards. So would the Health and Safety Executive like to make an initial comment on that before we see whether overnight there has been progress on finding a way forward.
Errol Merkan from the Health and Safety Executive.
Can you speak closely into the microphone, please?
Errol Merkan from the Health and Safety Executive. Unfortunately, there haven't been any developments since our discussions of yesterday afternoon. The position remains that the HSE's unchallenged evidence is that there is a human safety issue here arising from the two major accident hazard sites, and HSE's advice is to advise against the proposal on that basis. Ideally, HSE would like to see the situation resolved through a revocation or modification of the hazardous substances consents prior to the closure of the examination. If that doesn't happen, HSE is willing to consider as a fallback position a Grampian-type requirement, preventing the occupational use of the proposal until the hazardous substances consent issues have been resolved. A draft of the Grampian type requirement has been provided to TfL. In fact, indeed, there were discussions last week between Transport for London and the HSE. At that meeting, the Transport for London outlined for the first time some of the matters that Mr. Humphreys raised yesterday at the hearing to do with the CPO and the TfL's reluctance regarding a Grampian. But as things stand, HSE doesn't see an alternative. There is clearly work that needs to be done in this regard, and HSE submit that it's necessary to consider appropriate wording for a Grampian type requirement in the DCO.
Thank you very much. Can I just ask you a question that in a sense relates forward to tomorrow, where I assume that you're not going to be present if you want to get away early today. There is the question of the application to rebuild Studio 338 adjoining the gas holder opposite Brentag. So it's within both your consultation zones, I think. What is the HSE's advice to the Royal Borough on that particular issue?
The HSE has yet to be consulted by Greenwich on that. I believe that Greenwich have been reminded of the need to consult HSE, but that hasn't happened yet. So once HSE's advice is requested, HSE will provide that.
Right. Obviously, these are very, in a sense, awkward issues for the inquiry, as there are people who are objecting to the compulsory acquisition powers on the basis that they're also objecting to that rebuilding. If the rebuilding didn't take place, some of the compulsory acquisition might not then be necessary. So there are interrelated matters with this examination, though clearly if they're not resolved by the close of the examination, we'll just have to make the best of where things have reached at the moment. But I had assumed that Greenwich would have consulted on that application already, and therefore you might have a view. I mean, since the issue that certainly the owners of that premises have put on record to the examining authority is that they're intending an exact rebuild of how it was, and therefore arguing that issues don't arise since it's not changing the status quo, but that may or may not be how legally under the legislation the situation would be construed. So I was really wondering whether we might have a view on that might help give us background information, if nothing more definitive, on that matter.
Sir, anything we do say at this stage would be speculation.
Yeah, so I say I'm not asking you to say this morning, but I say if there is any greater clarity on this issue before the close of the examination, it would probably be helpful.
HSC will ensure that we keep the examining authority up to date as matters develop.
Thank you. Well, before going back to Mr. Owen for a comment on what has been said this morning so far, perhaps I could ask the Royal Borough, Smith, to give any update she can on state of play, at least as far as Brentag is concerned, and maybe on the Studio 338 situation. From the correspondence we've had from Southern Gas Networks and earlier comments, that may be, I won't say impasse, but not a lot of movement, potentially.
Kim Smith, Greenwich Council. I'm afraid I can't give you the information this morning. I emailed our lead planner last night about it to ask for an update. I haven't had that back yet, but we will provide an update for deadline 3 on it.
Is the Royal Borough intending to be present tomorrow?
We weren't intending to be present tomorrow, but we could be.
I mean, Brentag have, I don't know whether they're in fact present today, but they have certainly said that they intend to be present tomorrow, so there may be an opportunity for some dialogue with Brentag through the examination tomorrow to at least move that situation along.
I'll speak to my planning colleagues about that today and see if they're able to attend tomorrow, because they'd be far better suited to have that conversation than I would.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Merkham, good morning. From HSE, was it Mr. Eric Merkham?
Yes, Errol Merkham.
Thank you very much for that clarification. If I could ask you a question, notwithstanding the results of your discussions with the applicant, are you proposing to submit your suggested wording for the Grampian requirement to us at deadline 3?
Yes, I think where we'd left the discussion with TfL was that there will be a version 2 of the statement of common ground will be provided to the examining authority, and that will contain the draft wording, albeit it may not be agreed draft wording, but there will be there'll be comments on that from Transport for London, and it will contain the actual proposed wording from HSC, certainly.
Thank you. That would be helpful so we can see the direction of travel that you're going in. Thank you.
Mr. Owen, if you'd like to come back on this particular point and before we move on.
Robbie Owen, Transport for London. Thank you, sir. I think on this we clearly discussed it a little bit yesterday, and we explained our misgivings about a straightforward Grampian requirement. We understand, you know, the position, and that clearly it would be better for these issues to be resolved by the end of the examination, but it's entirely possible that will not come about. We think that we are continuing to discuss these matters with the HSC. We had a chat with them last night, and we'll continue doing so. And put them a suggestion to try and deal with this in a way that avoids having that rather stark single Grampian requirement, and perhaps I can just explain where we think we might want to go on this. We think it would be helpful to try to see if the Hazardous Substances Authority, London Borough Greenwich, can produce in relation to both the gas holder site and the Brentag chemical site some form of letter of no impediment, which I think would be of assistance to you and the Secretary of State, but that's likely to be insufficient on its own, not least given what you heard yesterday from the HSE. We think therefore that given the difficulty that Mr. Humphreys outlined yesterday with a straightforward cramping condition, the issues with that can be materially sort of mitigated in two ways. First, by that letter of no impediment concept that I mentioned. But secondly, we are wanting to develop, if I can put it this way, a sort of a two-headed requirement, in that the requirement would provide that the tunnel couldn't be used until the relevant hazardous substance consent had been revoked in the case of the gas holder station, or modified in the case of Brenntag, or if TfL has submitted to the Secretary of State an assessment of the risk to the public associated with the scheme operating in the vicinity of the gas holder or the chemicals site, and on the basis of that risk assessment and following consultation with the HSE and the Hazardous Substances Authority, the Secretary of State has confirmed that the tunnel may be and is therefore safe to be opened. So that is something that we're thinking of developing, and we put that in outline to the HSE's lawyers last night, and we're ready to share wording with them now, but we would be more comfortable with that, and we think it would provide an appropriate mechanism at some point in the future, if there's some issue with revoking or modifying, as the case may be, the consent, that there is an alternative mechanism, an alternative option for TfL to go to the Secretary of State with a proper risk assessment, saying, well, even though those consents are still in place, we think, for the reasons set out in the assessment, that the tunnel is safe to be used, and it would then be up to the Secretary of State to make that decision, taking advice from the HSE, as is normal, and consulting the local authority. That is, as I say, we're working on that sort of approach, which we would be considerably more comfortable with than just a straightforward Grampian. So that's probably as much as I can say at this stage, sir, and we look forward to discussing that further with the HSE.
Thank you very much. Before I just go back and see whether HSE want to say anything further on that rather more specific explanation of where we are, I take it that the applicant has seen the representation received in the last day or so from I think it's you and I, who are, I think, the freeholders of part of the Morden Wharf, who are seeking the Brenntag hazardous substance permit to be modified to a greater extent than was originally suggested, just simply to get this through, which might then, it may complicate matters, but it may also perhaps may enable more rapid progress if Brenntag and you and I sort of cooperate with one another, as well as TfL's good officers. But if you've seen it, that's fine. You will be taking that into account in trying to move things forward, presumably.
Robbie Owen, so we have seen it, and exactly that we'll be taking into account, yes.
Did you want to come back, Mr. Mayor?
Whilst this isn't a fully considered response to Mr. Owen's proposal, of course, this additional risk assessment, I don't quite understand how it would interact with the HSE's advice, which remains, I'm going to go back to it, unchallenged, and it's to advise against the proposal. So there it is, it's in black and white, no one has challenged that. And the HSE is the Secretary of State and the Great Britain's safety advisor on these matters.
I think you clearly
what a further risk assessment would add to that.
Clearly, from what you're saying, there is some way to go in discussions to reach, if it is possible, a mutually acceptable solution.
Robbie Owen, so perhaps I can just maybe clarify that particular point, because this further risk assessment is not one that would be produced before the DCO is made, if it is made. That would come later, so the HSE's advice against would stand, but that would be, in effect, overcome by the first head of the requirement, the straightforward Grampian. So it would, in that respect, be unchallenged but dealt with through the Grampian. That would be the solution to it. But the second head of the requirement would be one that would be open to TfL to operate later on once the order is made. If there were to be, which we think is unlikely for the reasons discussed yesterday, an issue with revocation and modification of the consents, it would be an option to allow TfL to go to the Secretary of State with a risk assessment at that stage, to say, well, for the reasons set out in the assessment, we think this tunnel, which is now about to be ready to be opened, can safely be opened. I hope that assists the HSE.
Mr. Owen, I did raise yesterday an alternative trigger being start of construction rather than actually opening, which clearly doesn't put us, you know, the financial risk, only a risk of delay to the project. That has, you know, TfL are no happier with that, I take it.
Robbie Owen, we yet to have enough time to consider that fully, but I can immediately see that would give rise to a whole host of difficulties, I suspect, given the stage got with procurement and financing of the project.
I mean, I was merely contemplating that, you know, in the sense HSE stressing that, you know, they didn't feel that your other suggestion would solve it. One can see a certain sort of gun at the head, pistol at the head of the Secretary of State for Transport if a very large sum of money has already been expended and the works are there and it's everyone's being told that they can't use it. So there is clearly a problem that a way around has got to be found in some way, whether through land acquisitions and matters of that nature might progress things, but clearly the gas people at least consider they have development potential and that the way they are acting is helping their situation. But anyway, we are where we are, and we'll have to deal with it as we can. So I think at that point we can, if the health and safety executive representatives wish to now to depart, I'm not aware that there is any other matter that we're likely to bring up that directly involves you. So if you would like to depart, that's a fine by us.
Thank you, sir.
Well, if we now could turn... Sorry, were you wanting? No. If we could now turn to the views of the boroughs on where all the different boroughs stand in relation to these changes in the composition of STIG and these discussions that are going on about its operation and the relationship of the other documents to it. Clearly, in yesterday's examination session, there was reference to the fact that document 711, charging policies and procedures, will be further updated on at least two further deadlines, at deadline 3 in terms of its approach, and in deadline 4 with more detailed and extensive modified triggers being actually put into it. So I think in this part of the today's discussion, it might well be helpful to flag up any more specific points that might need to go into the documents that are related to the operation of the Somertown Tunnel Information Group, which presumably would involve both the TIMS and the monitoring strategy as they are brought into play through that approach. So... I'm afraid I can't read the marker from here. So,
can I just introduce myself? My name is Thomas Hill, H-I-L-L, Queen's Counsel. I'm instructed by Mrs. Catherine Knight of the Borough of Newham. And if I may just say, my intention is to occupy no more than a very short part of your morning. Our response will be in two parts. And if with your leave, what I would like to do, and my role in today's proceedings is simply this, is to set a little context for the detailed points that will follow. This context is all in relation to the user charging proposals, and of course what I say has to take on board that this is a fluid process. We understand that further discussions are underway, that we are to hear more from TfL on their detailed proposals, both at deadline 3 and deadline 4. Nonetheless, we think it's important, with your leave, just to set out shortly some of the points of context that we hope will inform both the panel and TfL in its approach to the implications of user charging for the residents and workers of the Borough of Newham. So what I'd like to do is just make these short points and then hand over to the officers who will give you a more detailed account of the borough's response. So as you will be aware, having read the material, Newham has long expressed support in principle for a package of additional crossings off the Thames in its vicinity in order both to reduce congestion and improve access to key regeneration areas within the borough. But this support has always been contingent upon, firstly, a full understanding of the impacts of any such proposal, and secondly, the securing of appropriate mitigation in respect of such impacts where necessary. Now, sir, the Silvertown Tunnel DCO has given rise to particular concern because it proposes not only to introduce user charging for the new tunnel, but also to introduce, for the first time in its 120-year history, charging on the Blackwall Tunnel. Now, this tunnel, as you probably heard already, was constructed by London County Council to serve East London in 1897. And it's operated as a free means of crossing the river for those living and working in its vicinity ever since, with the additional bore opening in 1967. It's a statement of the obvious that charging at the levels currently proposed, £3 to £4 per car per trip, will present a significant financial burden to residents of the London Borough of Newham, and especially its vulnerable lower income groups. Now, the borough's concerns about the Silvertown Tunnel DCO relate in large part, as you will have seen from our previous representations, to inadequate consideration having been given to impacts on these groups, in our view, by TfL, either in terms of identifying the scale of the impacts or in terms of addressing them, be that by securing public transport provision in a way which will directly serve those who are no longer able to afford to travel by car, or by providing discounts, exemptions or a community fund to those who will still need to travel by car but will be presented with highly unattractive alternative routes. Now, as you will have seen, the TfL socioeconomic assessment appears to operate on an aggregate level only and doesn't really reveal the impacts on the deprived wards in Newham in close proximity to the tunnel portals. And we believe it's likely that those who live in those wards will experience disproportionate impacts, but this cannot, of course, be ascertained with any level of detail on the information so far provided by TfL.
Against this background, Newham has consistently expressed surprise that charging for the Blackwall Tunnel has been introduced as an ancillary or consequential element of the DCO, with, of course, the tunnel even omitted from the order limits. Indeed, we think this is far removed from the substantive reliance placed upon the tunnel charging, as fundamental, as Blackwall Tunnel charging, as fundamental to the proposals. We've heard earlier in the week, 77% of the flows expected to use the Blackwall Tunnel and Silvertown Tunnel in combination are predicted to use the Blackwall Tunnel. So Blackwall Tunnel charging will represent the lion's share of the income stream apparently needed to finance the scheme. And to us, it doesn't appear as ancillary or consequential element of the proposals, but rather as their linchpin. Now, we can find no precedent in a DCO or an Act for charging being imposed on a nearby, previously untolled river crossing as part of the consent for a new crossing. Now, the Seven Bridges Act 92 has been referred to in TfL's Deadline 2 responses. That provided for harmonisation of charges across the two Seven Bridges, one already open and tolled, the other authorised by the Act. And, of course, those of us old enough to remember will recall the same applied with the Dartford Thurrock Crossing Act, as the bridge and its tolls were authorised to supplement the capacity at the pre-existing tunnels which were already tolled. Now, the Planning Act 2008 does not expressly authorise the tolling of an existing road without more. And we know that the Transport Minister's statement to the House of Commons in July 2013 made plain that the government has a clear commitment not to toll existing road capacity, and this has not changed. Now, you will have also seen from our earlier representations that in London, Section 295 and Schedule 23 of the Greater London Authority Act 1999 authorise the imposition of road user charging, subject to quite an elaborate procedure in respect of designated areas, subject to full consultation, and with the power to hold a public inquiry into objections. Now, that procedure has obviously not been deployed by TfL for the Blackwall Tunnel, and it has, for all practical purposes, been sidestepped by the promotion of the DCO. And BT Blackwall Tunnel charging is introduced as ancillary or incidental to the Silvertown Tunnel order. Blackwall Tunnel doesn't even feature in the name of the order. So it's unclear whether all users of Blackwall Tunnel who would be affected by the DCO will have picked up the fundamental change proposed. Now, not only does the Planning Act 2008 not provide powers for the tolling of existing roads, it doesn't authorise the Silvertown Tunnel project, as you'll be very well aware. The use of a DCO has only been possible because of the Section 35 direction obtained from the Secretary of State on the 1st of June 2012. Again, that's in the material before the panel. By which the Silvertown Tunnel development is, and I quote, to be treated as development for which development consent is required. Now, I mention this, sir, simply because the application to the Secretary of State does not indicate that the DCO will be used to impose charging on the Blackwall Tunnel. It simply states that the viability of a range of funding options to enable delivery are, it says, probably should be, is now being considered. So, 2012, charging of the Blackwall Tunnel was not foreshadowed, but a range of funding options was being considered. Now, that should have been the case at the time of the application to the Secretary of State is significant for two reasons. I'm nearly at the end, so please bear with me. First, TfL cannot claim that inclusion of Blackwall Tunnel user charging was expressly considered and accepted by the Secretary of State as part of the direction-making process. And second, Blackwall Tunnel charging cannot be claimed as an inevitable part of the package, as it was plainly not so regarded in 2012. Now, TfL make their point in their Deadline 2 response that Blackwall Tunnel is not subject to any of the land and works provisions in the DCO. Now, we think this means that Section 144 of the Planning Act is not available to TfL in relation to Blackwall Tunnel charging, because we think those powers are directed to the imposition of tolls on new roads. And, of course, Section 144 applies to tolls, not to user charges, which are subtly different. As we understand the position, TfL falls back upon Section 120 of the Planning Act to find authority for Blackwall Tunnel charging as either ancillary to the Silvertown Tunnel development or necessary or expedient for giving full effect to any other provision of the order, incidental, consequential, supplementary provisions. It might be thought, sir, that these provisions were intended to capture subordinate but supportive elements of proposals, temporary TRAs, etc., ancillary or consequential, rather than primary or fundamental elements of the proposals, such as the means of providing 77% of the income stream. Now, just to close, BT charging, Blackwall Tunnel charging, by the imposition of a new tax on Blackwall Tunnel users in perpetuity, represents the end of 120 years of free use of the Blackwall Tunnel for the people of East London and represents the opportunity to create a new multi-million pound revenue stream for TfL. And it certainly seems inherently unlikely to Newham that this can be achieved with no recognition of the Blackwall Tunnel in the order limits and, we say, patently insufficient consideration of the likely impacts upon the most vulnerable communities in Newham and how they can be properly mitigated. As I say, the DCO is plainly a document in flux. New proposals are now apparently to be forthcoming for incorporation within the DCO in relation to the provision of public transport services and other mitigation for affected communities, which directly address the impacts of removing a free river crossing to so many of the residents and workers in this part of East London. Now, as that happens, and we hear that it may be deadline 3, it may be deadline 4, we hope it's as soon as possible. We've been asking for these matters to be looked at for some time. It will enable the borough to give these matters further consideration and to review whether, in the round, the package of proposals as ultimately put forward in the draft DCO is capable of being authorised by the Planning Act 2008. Now, all that I've just said, if it's helpful, will be committed to writing as part of our deadline 3 response, but I'm grateful to you, sir, ma'am, sir, for hearing me out.
Well, indeed, I'm grateful for that background explanation. It does seem to me, though, to raise, in a sense, almost a fundamental incompatibility in the different aspects of that approach. If, in a sense, to follow your principal line of argument, that the should not be a means of imposing the charges through this procedure, even if a mitigation package that was then acceptable to Newham came forward, so the Newham said that, well, we're actually quite happy with the overall package, if what you have said about the inability to follow this procedure is correct, that still might make it impossible to go ahead, even if Newham had been satisfied by the mitigation.
We're not saying that, sir. We're not saying that, but we are saying that the statutory context and the factual context are such that this requires really very considerable scrutiny, both by TfL and by the panel, to ensure that even if it's still called the Silvertown Tunnel DCO, what it does in substance is to provide properly for the transport needs of both sides of the river at the point of the crossing. And if looked at holistically, it does do that, and the needs of vulnerable communities are properly addressed, then it may well be that we can conclude that there is no vires or jurisdictional point. But at the moment, we certainly can't conclude that. But I'm not making this as a final submission on this point. I'm flagging up these concerns, flagging up the issues that remain to be grappled with by TfL, and are waiting to hear what they say. Not now, but in the context of their responses to the various substantive concerns that both the boroughs and the panel have raised with them.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, we'll obviously later today come into the issue of these mitigation packages and how they will be secured. But probably at this point it might be appropriate to go back to Transport for London. But before just inviting Mr. Owen or Mr. Humphreys to come back over those points, it seems to me that this also raises an issue in relation to the points that the panel had raised earlier about whether ultimately it will be for the Secretary of State to decide under Sections 104 or 105 of the Planning Act. Interestingly, for instance, the National Networks Policy Statement, which would be the prime consideration if it was Section 104, does expressly include the reference to that state parliamentary announcement in 2012. I mean, whether it does it by name, but it says that it is not the government's intention to impose charges on existing roads. So, in a sense, proceeding to place the full weight rather than it being a relevant and material consideration, which there's no doubt that the National Policy Statement is, whichever way one looks at it, that does introduce a particular issue that has to be grappled with if one is going down that route rather than relying on the London plan, which at policy 6.1 does obviously says that there should be a crossing at Silvertown.
It's how that relates to the Blackwald Tunnel and the imposition of charging on that, which I think is at the heart of our concern.
So, Transport for London, Mr. Owen.
Robbie Owen, thank you. Sir, thank you. We think it would be helpful to say a few words at this stage. We'll obviously wait to see what London Borough of Newham produced in writing. This is the first we've heard of this approach of theirs on the legality of charging Blackwall Tunnel. Obviously what we say now is just an opening response, really. As you'd expect, we've given a lot of consideration to this issue over several years and are comfortable that Blackwall Tunnel can be lawfully charged under the provisions of the Development Consent Order. We're in no doubt that Mr. Hill referred to Section 144 of the Planning Act. We're in no doubt that that is not restricted just to tolls, and indeed there was a parliamentary debate on that very issue a couple of years ago. I think probably the best thing is I'd like to ask Mr. Humphreys just to outline our response on this point. We can confer that at deadline 3, but I suspect because we're not going to see Newham's response until deadline 3, we're not going to be able to give you our final response on it either, because we're going to need to see what is said in writing. But it's certainly helpful to have the heads up from Mr. Hill as to the direction of travel that they are going. So I think if I can just ask Mr. Humphreys to elaborate on our position, that would be helpful.
Yes, sir. I've got, you won't have it, but I've got the Act in front of me on the screen, so I'll just refer to certain things if you have the Act available.
I have a copy.
Thank you, sir. So if you could turn to Section 120. That's the section that explains what may be included in an order granting development consent. And draw your attention. I won't go through this in extenso. Mr. Hill was kind enough to say he put his things in writing and will respond. But if you look at Section 120, subsection 3, it says that an order granting development consent may make provision relating to or matters ancillary to the development for which development consent is granted. So that's where, and you heard Mr. Hill refer to it, you get the relating to or ancillary to concepts, and those are obviously quite important to understand. And that's relating to or ancillary to the development. Subsection 4 tells you that the provision may be made under subsection 3 includes, and the word includes is important, in particular provision for or relating to any of the matters in part 1 of Schedule 5. So, in other words, the word includes makes it clear that part 1 of Schedule 5 is not exclusive because the primary power is in subsection 3. Anything that relates to or is ancillary to, but they've very helpfully listed for us a number of the matters. And in part one of schedule 5, paragraph 18 of that schedule, I may suggest you look it up now, but that includes charging of tolls, fares, or other charges. So the Act quite specifically contemplates as one of the identified list, although it's not an exclusive list, tolls, fares, or other charges. Here, this is not a toll, it's a charge, it's a user charge. And the reason is a toll would normally be something which is exclusively to pay for something. Here, as you will know in detail from the evidence, that the user charge actually is not simply to pay for, it does have an effect of contributing towards costs, but it's also to control flows and manage the network. Now, section 144 that was referred to, sorry, I have to try and find this by scrolling on a screen, so I'll do that, but it's important to understand again that draws this distinction between tolls, when I get to it, and other charges. It starts off section 144, which is not it's not giving the primary power. That's section 120. But it says an order granting development consent may include provision authorizing the charging of tolls in relation to a highway, only if a request to that effect has been included. Well, we haven't asked for a toll. But if an order granting development consent includes provision of charging of tolls in relation to a highway, then it tells you that the New Roads and Streetworks Act applies. But subsection 2A is important. Subsection 2 does not apply to an order that includes provision for authorizing other charges in respect of the use of motor vehicles on roads, which is what we are. So in other words, the 1991 New Roads and Streetworks Act isn't engaged in this case because this is not a toll. We haven't asked for a toll. We've asked for a user charge. Now, going back to section 120, I do apologise, so this is me trying to...
I probably, by not using my laptop but using a paper copy, I may be having an advantage.
So you are streets ahead of me on this, technology bound. Section 120, subsection 5, is also quite important. It says that an order granting development consent may, and then C, include any provision that appears to the Secretary of State to be necessary or expedient to give full effect to any other provision of the order. Now, obviously, in this case, it is very clear from the provisions I've referred to, section 120, subsection 3 and 4, that we are able to raise a charge on the Silvertown Tunnel itself.
Can I helpfully intervene and say that isn't in dispute?
That is helpful. Thank you. And the evidence that we've put forward that has been discussed in various of the hearings, and we've been asked about it in the written questions, makes clear that the Silvertown Tunnel only operates correctly and allows us to manage the traffic network and the flows, which I know a number of the boroughs, in fact, including Newham, are very concerned about, if we are also able to control the flows through the Blackwall Tunnel, because without that, the Blackwall Tunnel would be uncharged and would have very high flows. Silvertown would be charged, and the result of that, as the evidence obviously would make clear, would be A, an imbalance between the two tunnels, but secondly, would mean that rather than being able to control the flows to broadly the same as what the existing flow is, and thereby mitigate the congestion and the other adverse effects of the tunnel as it operates at the moment, and even more so as it would operate in the future with the high flows predicted with growth in London, we simply wouldn't be able to do that, and therefore it's clear that either the tunnel itself falls within section 123 or section 124, the Blackwall Tunnel, either falls within that or in any event would fall within 5C, because it would be necessary or expedient to give full effect to the other provision of the order, in other words, the charging that we were undertaking on the Silvertown Tunnel and the need to control the flows generally. Now, it's said in relation to that that, of course, we have powers under the Greater London Authority Act for certain forms of charging, and that is right. We consider it necessary and expedient, however, and appropriate to bring forward the charging regime in one place so that you can consider those effects. If we were to approach this saying that we were only going to charge one tunnel, but we were going to try to go through a process under other legislation to charge another tunnel, you might legitimately say, well, what confidence do we have? Have we already done that? And what are the control mechanisms for the charging of that other tunnel? It's clearly appropriate to bring these forward together so that the user charging policy and procedure and the project objectives and the various policies in that document can apply equally to both tunnels, and you can consider that, and the Secretary of State can consider that in the round. A number of other points were made which weren't perhaps central, I think, to Mr. Hill's central submission here, but I'll just touch on. He made the point about disproportionate impacts. So as I won't repeat it in detail, but you will know from the socio-economic analysis that it's actually the low-income groups that receive by far the greatest proportion of the user benefits from this scheme.
I think we went through this yesterday. I don't think that was necessarily a matter agreed by all those sitting around the table. So.
It's what the analysis shows. If they want to bring forward another one, of course they can. It's also said that at the time of the Section 35 application, that at that point it wasn't said that there would be charging on the Blackwall Tunnel. So that's not necessary. It was the project, the development, the tunnel that was in respect of which was the direction. Clearly, as part of this process, the Secretary of State because the application is before him and we consulted on the application with all parties, including Newham, the Secretary of State has an opportunity to consider whether or not there should be that charging on the Blackwall Tunnel. It's not as though by making this direction in some way there was sleight of hand and no one's had the opportunity to consider that. So clearly the Secretary of State has the opportunity to consider this at that stage. And, it was very clearly included in the statutory consultation that was included under the scheme. So I think, sorry, in many respects, I would want to make the point that you made. On the one hand, Newham are very keen for there to be a package of measures improving cross-river connectivity in this part of London. We've demonstrated why it is necessary in order to control the environmental and other impacts to have charging on both tunnels. If Newham want to put forward a positive case to say that the flows could be controlled and the environmental effects kept within appropriate limits without charging on the Blackwall Tunnel, then let's hear it. But if this is just a sort of, nice legal point, then it doesn't really take things further forward. And that actually, of course, this is an inquisitorial process, and that's not just inquisitorial of us, it's inquisitorial of other parties, and therefore you should inquire of the Newham officers what work they have done to understand whether appropriate flows can be maintained and environmental limits respected with charging on the Silvertown Tunnel but not on the Blackwall Tunnel. I think that would be an interesting area of inquiry.
Thank you very much, Mr. Humphreys. That was not what I had perceived their case to be, rather that there needed to be a compensatory package to overcome the detriment to some low-income users. One accepts that in aggregate terms, as long as there is the bus benefits, which we're going to come on to as to how those are secured, then yes, there may be an aggregate in the economic analysis. But as I understand it, it is this package that is being sought of benefits by Newham, but I suspect I will going to hear that it's also being sought by Tower Hamlets and Greenwich, maybe others too, but certainly by the, I will use the term not probably strictly legally accurately, the three host boroughs, but the 2+1 host boroughs.
I think so. As far as the mitigation packages and buses, again a point was made, and we did explain, I think, through Mr. Rowe yesterday that we are now looking for a mechanism to give some greater confidence about the provision of bus services. I think on community funds generally, obviously in respect of sums of money handed over, those would have to respect the normal rules in relation to, reasonably related to the development and proportionate and all of those sorts of matters. As far as discounts are concerned, I mean, we've had a lot of debate.
I think we're getting back
that.
Into matters we've covered on earlier days.
No, sir, I agree. I simply was making the point, because you raised discounts, that I think that takes us back to those discussions, and we've explained.
I think I repeat my comment that I made after Mr. Hill had made his presentation. You have argued, Mr. Humphreys, as to why legally it is possible. Mr. Hill has raised questions as to whether it may not be legally possible. At the end of the day, the law is the law, and a judgment will have to be made on these matters. what, in a sense, almost whatever the panel recommends, the Department for Transport's lawyers will ponder these points if they are, well, they have been raised. It depends on whether they will be subsequently pressed. But at the end of the day, as I understand it, Newham are basically saying that there needs to be an acceptable package of mitigation. Whether there will be agreement on what that acceptable package might be is another matter. But what I think today's proceedings, we would be wanting to talk about how packages, whatever they may contain, might be secured within the DCO. In other words, to keep us focused on what today's hearing is about.
So I think Mr. Hill's point goes beyond that. The only purpose of raising a legal point, because the legal point doesn't go to whether or not there is an appropriate mitigation package. That's
indeed,
a matter for the evidence.
Indeed,
the legal point appeared to be that there wasn't power to charge on the Blackwall Tunnel.
I tell you, I fully understand that, and I say at the end of the day, there either is or there isn't.
Correct.
We can't probably. Well, we're not a court here to make a judgment on that. If it is ultimately pressed to such a judgment, so I think we need to move on to.
Of course, sir. No. Absolutely. I was simply making a response to the legal point.
It was an extremely helpful response, Mr. Humphreys, in setting the counterpoints to what Mr. Hill had raised earlier. So that was extremely helpful. Thank you. Right. Well, we'll move from left to right. Can you introduce yourself, please?
Sure. My name is James Burton from the London Borough of Newham. Moving on from those legal points, I'd just like to address the agenda item more specifically in terms of how those specific articles and documents allow a local authority or allow sufficient flexibility to adjust charges expeditiously.
So we are now talking about the agenda item 3, the STIG provisions and related documentation.
Correct. Yep. Yes. So I don't want to go into some of the points that have already been raised about monitoring and things yesterday, and also I don't want to labour on the Silvertown Tunnel Implementation Group, knowing that it could well be changed. But I think in its current form, we're not happy that we can expeditiously act to mitigate environmental measures. We don't have any triggers, unlike we do for traffic. And I think, importantly, the monitoring strategy that's currently been proposed...
Can you just clarify? You say you don't have any triggers unlike for the traffic.
There were some traffic impacts... triggers on things.
So you're saying you want triggers on environment?
Environmental. As I say, that was mentioned yesterday, so I don't want to labour on that. But a key concern of ours is with regards to the monitoring strategy and how it relates to STIG. I think there's a disconnect, and I think in meetings with TFL that they've sort of acknowledged this, so it might be something that they're working on. But the monitoring strategy is only required to report once a year. And then there's 3 months to prepare the report. So, in effect, after scheme opening, we would get a report on the monitoring, by 15 months. In that time, STIG will have met at 6 months and 12 months without any knowledge of monitoring required. To be fair, I will mention that within the monitoring strategy, it sets out that there is the ability to report on live impacts on a lot of the monitoring, but there's no requirement to pass that on. So I think that's something that we believe needs to be strengthened. Because otherwise we're going to have a situation where STIG meets and doesn't necessarily have up-to-date or current monitoring to be able to make necessary or the best possible recommendations to TFL for measures.
So basically you're saying that whatever changes may be made to the frequency of STIG meetings or its composition or method of working, which the discussions have been promised over, the monitoring strategy needs to be changed to introduce requirements for either real-time monitoring or more frequent reporting of the outputs of monitoring.
Yep, precisely so.
One point which has occurred to me, which I was going to raise later, but it possibly is a right good point to introduce it. It came up in discussions over the last 2 days, particularly the question of where the monitoring is taking place. And it may be a question that TfL will be able to provide an instant answer for. Where in the documentation, or is it not in any documentation at all, is the location of the areas to be monitored specified? Because clearly there were requests, whether it's from Westcombe Residence, East Greenwich Residence Association, London Borough of Southwark, our borough, and so on, for various different, more monitoring than seems to be currently envisaged. Are you going to give me the answer to that?
Yes, sir. Kim Smith, Greenwich. That information's contained in the user charging assessment framework document, and one of the points that we wanted to make was that isn't currently linked through the face of the DCO to either the monitoring and mitigation strategy or TIMS, but I've got some wider points to make, which I'll do in a little while.
So which document is that in any of the reference numbers that it might have, our own examination library or the TfL's?
I'll look up the references in the charging policies and procedures framework, which is...
Oh, it's in the charging policies,
yep.
It's document 711.
Yeah, rep 123/4. It's an appendice to that document.
So if more areas are accepted, more monitoring locations, then they ought to go into that document. So more changes to that document are also being sought.
Absolutely so.
Thank you very much. Perhaps had you concluded, Mr. Barton?
Yes, sir, I've concluded.
Okay, thank you. If we move on then to Greenwich.
Thank you, sir. Kim Smith, Greenwich. I'm not going to go through the detail of the documents. We've already documented our concerns over STIG and over the monitoring mitigation strategy. I simply wanted to say we welcome the fact that TfL are now talking to us in more detail about the changes that are required in this. Like our colleagues in Newham, we have a concern over the operation of STIG and the timely implementation of any mitigations which are sought and agreed. As part of our submission for deadline 3, we'll put some indicative timeframes in for works that could be required under the TIMS, which could take up to 2 years to actually implement. So it could mean we're living with the results of the outputs of the tunnel for 2 years before the mitigations could be put in place. That's something we'll go into in more detail. It's also the timeliness of STIG with an annual meeting to take forward the changes and discussions that are needed. We don't believe that's appropriate, and we believe TfL agree with us that needs to be changed. So I won't labour this point at the moment, but simply to say, as it stands, we have a level of concern over the monitoring and mitigation, the TIMS and STIG, but we're hopeful that some resolution will be found around that. Certainly we're not happy with the triggers in the TIMS at the moment, the level of change that has to be met before any action's taken, and like Newham, we would like to see environmental triggers included as well.
Where would you be suggesting the environmental triggers would go? Into the monitoring strategy or, in a sense, need to retitle the TIMS to call it traffic and environmental monitoring or something of that nature?
I'd prefer to see it in one document. Whichever document is more appropriate, fine, but it needs to be under one document so we're not scurrying around between documents and cross-referencing them.
Right. Well, that's obviously a matter, I think, which the panel and sense have raised earlier by suggesting that some of the charging documents came together so that we do consolidate. So, anyway. Well, we'll move on round then. If you can introduce yourself, I think... You were here yesterday, weren't you?
I have been a feature Sorry. This week, I apologise. Yes, it's Stephanie Hall on behalf of the London Borough of Southwark. Good morning. So just really to echo and emphasise what has been said by our neighbouring boroughs, so you invited comment via the agenda on whether there's sufficient flexibility to adjust the charges, and as drafted, the London Borough of Southwark does not consider that Article 65, as it's presently drafted, is an apt mechanism for effecting change in a timely fashion. So I think there's been essentially tacit acceptance of this by the applicant on Tuesday, and the discussion that we had then on the need for the applicant to have emergency, for want of a better term, powers to make kind of fast changes outside the mechanism of STIG. And in a similar way to points I've raised about a borough struggling to affect the implementation of mitigation measures via TIMS, the same point arises, so in my submission, as to a borough seeking to affect changes to the user charge via STIG and the monitoring documents that we've got. At present, a borough can't call a meeting, and that's certainly the case after the TIMS and the monitoring strategy are, I think the term used in the draft DCO as it is at the moment, is implemented. I'm not quite sure what that means in this context, but it may be that that refers to after the three-year or five-year monitoring period has elapsed. STIG doesn't have, there's no provision for STIG to have a regular meeting. And so if the boroughs cannot call a meeting and there is no regular meeting, it's really only going to be an effective change mechanism for effecting change if TfL seek to call a meeting, because they would like to effect some change to the use charge. So we obviously welcome TfL's comment this morning that there is an agreement to revisit the provisions and procedures of STIG, although it does really rather raise what I can usefully add, what we can usefully achieve today if the procedures of STIG are going to shift somewhat. There was mention in Mr. Owen's submissions to consulting the boroughs on the next iteration of the STIG procedures. I'd just like to kind of wave the flag and make a formal request, if I can, through you, sir, for the London Borough of Southwark to be included in those consultations, because we haven't to date. And certainly Southwark would very much like to be consulted on that. Thank you very much. I don't think we can take anything much further forward today, given the sort of shifting nature of where
Thank
we are
much.
With STIG.
Thank you. Well, moving on.
Thank you. Hello. My name's Simon Moss. I work for the London Borough of Lewisham. I don't want to take up too much time, but before I hand over to colleagues to raise some detailed points, I thought it'd be beneficial for the panel to hear directly from the borough about our overall position and how that relates to the importance of the wording of the DCO itself. We've heard various nuanced positions from other boroughs about the degree of support and objection. Our position is less nuanced. A motion was passed by our full council to object to the proposal as it stands, which is clearly coming forward in isolation. I won't go into the detailed reasoning for that objection, which is set out, obviously, in the written representations, but we heard on Tuesday about the three north-south corridors through Lewisham, which lead directly to either Rotherhithe or Blackwall. Our borough is particularly susceptible to displacement, and there is a real route choice. So through the wording of the DCO, controlling the user charge, controlling the displacement to Rotherhithe, and ensuring that traffic flows don't go over those stated in the ES are of utmost importance to us. The DCO, STIG, TIMS, monitoring strategy, charging policies, procedures, these are all important because as it stands, we don't have a firm commitment to, for example, the bus services. We welcome the commitment from TfL that it'll be revising the bus strategy and making some commitment to provision through the DCO at deadline three. But we've still got concerns about how services will be secured through the DCO. Greenwich and Bexley both welcomed the political, the potential commitment from TfL to a quantum of bus services specified in the assessed case. We welcome that too, but for us, I think that's a minimum requirement. We still believe there should be further commitment to bus provision, and that commitment could set out aims or considerations for a bus planning exercise, including targeting areas of low income, areas of low public transport accessibility, and areas, obviously, along the strategic corridors approaching all proposed and existing tunnels. I just want to make one final point, if I may, relating to Stig and Tim's and the monitoring strategy. The council objects to this tunnel coming forward in isolation. I recognise that other public transport crossings, like extending the DLR to Abbey Wood, have been mooted, but this, to be honest, really wouldn't do anything to offset the impacts that we expect to see in Lewisham. The wider package of crossings doesn't take any account of the potential mitigation around the Rotherhithe issue. Now, I don't expect the Silvertown tunnel to fund, for example, an overground extension from New Cross to Lewisham, but I do believe that Tim's should be supportive in recognising where wider schemes can offset potential impacts. In short, Stig should be able to endorse any infrastructure which offsets the impact of the tunnel, and that should be reflected in the wording of the DCO, including where surplus money generated from the user charge can be spent. Thank you. I'll just hand over to colleague Alison Squires.
Just before you do hand over, I would like to sort of just probe what you said. In one sense, it's a bit like the initial Newham position, that we're potentially against it, but we can be persuaded not to be. You said that your council has actually resolved that you object as it stands. What is the mechanism for, in a sense, that being changed to something else than if it's objection as it stands? What would make it different? You flagged up some areas that you want to see improved upon. At some point, what changes to the DCO are made? Will that go back to your council to say, well, now on balance, that you are of a different view?
The council's always been clear about supporting the principle of river crossings in East London. It's always felt that there should be a package, and primarily the priority should be for a fixed road link further east, the Galleons or the Belvedere links, which were previously being discussed, were certainly our preference, and with those in place or a firm commitment to those, or one of those, then one could foresee the council changing its position on Silvertown. Similarly,
You know that as part of this process, you are not going to get a commitment to build a road crossing at either of those locations, though there is a commitment to a DLR crossing at Galleons now.
That's right, and we don't see that the DLR crossing at Galleons is sufficient, hence our objection to the proposal as it stands.
So does that mean, in a sense, whatever changes to the DCO are made, you prefaced it as the wording of the DCO as it stands, but you're now implying that it's rather more fundamental than the wording of the DCO that are the only things that could change your council's position?
Clearly we want to make the best of a bad situation and secure as much mitigation as possible to offset the impacts, but that doesn't remove our objection.
Thank you very much. If you'd now like to make your contribution.
Thank you. Alison Squires, GVA, on behalf of both the London Borough of Lewisham and the London Borough of Hackney. I'd just like to add on some of the points that Simon made in relation to both the boroughs, and I will set out where I'm talking about just one borough and where I'm talking about both boroughs. So firstly, just for ease of reference, really, I'd just like to refer the examining authority back to the fact that our comments for both boroughs are set out in the written representations and also in our statements of common ground with TfL. And here we've quite clearly set out information on our concerns with the wording of the draft DCO, most importantly in relation to STIG. And I heard earlier from Mr. Owens that there will be obviously further discussions with the boroughs in relation to STIG, and we'd welcome those discussions similar to Southwark. But we'd also like to make a similar point that since agreeing our statements to common ground for deadline one, we haven't had further discussions as yet with TfL on behalf of Lewisham or Hackney. So we'd just like to really again kind of raise that flag that we'd really like as neighbouring boroughs to be involved in those discussions with STIG, as clearly also affects both Hackney and Lewisham. And in particular, we'd welcome discussions on STIG, on the traffic impacts mitigation strategy, including the triggers, also the monitoring strategy. We'd also like discussions with TfL on general mitigation, including specifically for Lewisham, recognition of wider rail and corridor measures that my colleague, Mr. Moss, just mentioned, and also wider discussions on bus provision, which I understand we may come back later to today. And I'd just like to just take maybe about 5 minutes just going through what our, very briefly, what our issues are. Firstly, in relation to TIMS and the monitoring strategy, we mentioned on Tuesday a couple of our concerns in relation to both Lewisham and Hackney on some of the triggers introduced for Appendix A of TIMS, and I won't revisit what we set out there, and we will put this in our written submissions. But just very briefly, in summary, for the London Borough of Lewisham, we'd really like to re-raise the concern that we really want monitoring to cover the three north-south corridors that run through Lewisham, at least down to the south.
I think, circular. In a sense, I touched upon that with Greenwich, that if we'd established where they are, that they're in that document 711, that's what, in a sense, you need to be pressing to be changed as part of this discussion.
Okay, thank you. We'll put those comments in our written representations. So if I could move on just to set out our actual substantive concerns with STIG, and I do appreciate that we will be hopefully having discussions with TfL on this point, but I am instructed just to briefly set out very quickly in summary what our concerns are. And our concerns really about the role in the formation of STIG. So our first significant point on behalf of both boroughs is about STIG needing stronger governance. And here the view of both London Borough of Lewisham and London Borough of Hackney is that the chair should be an independent chair. As it's currently worded, TfL will be the chair. And in the case of an equality of votes, TfL would get that casting vote on a decision. So our suggestion is that the chair of STIG should be independent rather than, to some extent, TfL making a recommendation to its own board. Our second significant point in relation to STIG is that we would suggest there is some reference within STIG or within one of the certified documents about the capping of future traffic levels to those specified in the ES. And I'm conscious that we covered this point to some extent on Tuesday in relation to TIMS, but we'd just like to reiterate that really the point here is that the ES has assessed those parameters of traffic through the assess case. And we, from our review, we can't see that set out anywhere within any of the draft DCO documents. So we'd really like that set out so that it's very clear for STIG when they come to looking at monitoring and mitigation that where those levels are exceeded, that's a trigger for them.
I think it was accepted that this would be looked at. Yeah.
Thank you. Our other more minor points are in relation to STIG, that we feel it should be STIG rather than TfL that are able to invite other bodies to join STIG. As currently worded, TfL have the authority to invite other bodies to join STIG. We feel that should be a STIG decision. Our further recommendation solely on behalf of London Borough of Lewisham is that the STIG recommendations on user charges should be binding. And on this basis, at the moment, TfL solely have to have regard to any recommendations made by STIG on user charges. And our suggestion for Lewisham is that it should be binding due to the importance of user charges on managing traffic flows and to prevent a political decision by TfL or the Mayor. And just to run through a couple of other points, our other more minor points in relation to STIG are that boroughs should be able to request a STIG meeting, a similar point to that made by London Borough of Southwark. In terms of the STIG review committee, at the moment that is set up to be representatives from the host boroughs, the 2+1, plus representatives from TfL, we would suggest, as per the requirement for STIG being CORAT, that at least two other representatives from the list of those included in STIG should also be on that review group. In terms of making information made public, and I'm conscious this is a later agenda item, but the view of both our boroughs is that information minutes and information that goes to STIG should be made public on the basis that TfL is a public body, and similar, our boroughs involved in those discussions are public bodies. And just final 3 points, in terms of provision of information, we would suggest that information gets provided to STIG members at least 4 weeks in advance to ensure that London boroughs have sufficient time for any delegated authority for decisions and votes to make at that STIG meeting. And also potentially that more information is needed on STIG, and I obviously welcome this discussion that Mr. Owens mentioned earlier, just how it will actually work.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. I see we passed by Tower Hamlet, so if we can have...
I'll make 4 points, which I don't think have been addressed elsewhere. The first thing is that I suppose it picks up the points that have been made about how STIG decisions are made. I think our concern has been to avoid a situation when TfL could simply overrule a decision made by STIG, and not even if there was unanimous decision to support something. And maybe a neutral chair might be something, or we suggested in some sort of third party might look at a decision if there was disagreement between STIG and TfL. The second point is the importance of monitoring and mitigation, not just of traffic. We made this point yesterday, but it struck me this morning that those of you who watched the morning news will have noted that the London's air quality target for the year has been exceeded already, and we're only a few days into January. And also on the same announcement, there was a long queue at the Blackwall Tunnel, which might be regarded as being justification for the scheme, but the point is that that traffic would generate an awful lot of emissions. And I suppose the question is, how could STIG give effect to some sort of mitigation for that sort of situation? Could it act quickly enough in terms of either the user charge or some of the other mechanisms to deal with that? And I was thinking back to Paris that bans all vehicles on odd days as a means of dealing with air quality. In terms of mitigation for socio-economic impacts, the point has been made about the importance of bus services, and Tower Hamlets would want to make sure those bus services did actually serve the borough rather than just other parts of North London, because the areas of disadvantage in Tower Hamlets are dispersed across the whole borough. They aren't just concentrated around, for example, the tunnel entrances. In fact, most of the borough's higher income residents live in that sort of area. The other aspect of that is that at the moment, looking at the various traffic analysis, the main beneficiary or the main user of the Blackwater on the morning peak hour that come into Tower Hamlets are travelling into the Isle of Dogs, and they are presumably the more affluent commuters, which is fine, but there needs to be consideration given to the other effects of that high user charging in relation to small businesses in the borough. And we made the point that there should be some means of actually ensuring that small businesses have disbenefits from the charging regime. We talked about a business discount or something, but there may be other mechanisms of ensuring small businesses don't lose out as a result of having to come through the tunnel in the morning peak hour. I think otherwise the points made, we also welcome the changes in the way that the STIG will operate. But
can you speak more clearly
sorry
into
about
the
that.
Microphone?
We welcome the other changes proposed to STIG, and we'll wait and see what happens. I think in fact it will be deadline 4, because the next meeting with boroughs is not until after deadline 3. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We've obviously had a lot of points made there. I'm not... Oh, sorry, we've still got...
Sorry, Murray Woodburn, London Borough of Newham. If I could just make another point in relation
right,
to...
Right, so we're having 3 Newham contributions.
Yes, I'm sorry, we kind of moved past me to Kim without me being able to interject sufficiently, so I thought I would just wait. The issue... we've discussed just now how timeously it may be able to implement mitigation based on supply of data and meetings in relation at the schedule of STIG meetings. But I think there's a third issue which we would like the applicant to consider within
within the TIMS strategy. And that is how long it then will subsequently take, once we have agreed for some kind of mitigation, to actually implement that mitigation on the ground. Now, the reason I mention this is that traffic signals are always quoted as the automatic example as to how mitigation will be achieved, but all of the boroughs have received recent notification from Transport for London Traffic Infrastructure, the signals people, about the likely lead-in times that we are to expect in relation to the delivery of these implementations. And we would like to see some kind of securing of both auditing and approval resources within Transport for London to ensure that we can promptly mitigate against these. Because otherwise, as I said, and as has been said previously, there will be a considerable time lag between the identification of an impact and even between STIG agreeing that a mitigation is necessary.
I think this point was made by...
Finally, just one further clarification, which I picked up on something that you said, sir, Chair, saying that the DLR Galleons Crossing is committed now because it appears in the TfL business plan. Well, if I can just give you a list of the projects that have occurred and have appeared in the business plan since 2010, which have not happened, including the Thames Gateway Bridge, Cross River Tram, Croydon Tramlink Extension, the Oxford Street Tram or Transit, East London Transit, the DLR extension to Dagenham Dock. All of these have been expressly referred to in a TfL business plan in the past. So I would just like to make it clear
I think my comment was not necessarily just referring to the business plan, but it is part of the Mayor's statement in relation to this particular examination that scheme is to go ahead. So I would perhaps see it as slightly different from some of these other things that may or may not have been in... Well, I don't want to say may or may not. Yes, have been in business plans in the past.
Okay.
Thank you. Well, obviously, I'll want to now allow TfL to make a response to those general comments that have a certain degree of commonality, but some particular points. There was one point that was occurred to me. Obviously, many of them are of the kinds of matters that will be now discussed, and I think I would assume that that would be the terminology and the content of charging policies and procedures document, the monitoring strategy, and the TIMS, as well as just the wording in the orders about the operation of STIG. But there was a reference to the calling of the STIG after the implementation of the scheme, and there was a question raised, what did implementation actually mean, and I don't know whether that is a point that you could answer for our benefit now, even if many of these other points have to be subject of ongoing discussions.
Yeah. Robbie Owen, Transport for London. Thank you, sir. I think I can be relatively brief. And first, can I thank all of the boroughs for those comments, which are helpful and will be added into the melting pot for our discussions with them. And I can also give an assurance that, as TfL has been doing to date, all of the boroughs will be consulted on these further issues. I don't believe I did just refer to the host boroughs. If I did, that was a clear error, but I don't think I did. TfL wants to achieve as broad consensus as possible from all the boroughs, so those efforts will continue. And yes, sir, the products will be not only revised drafting of the relevant provisions of the DCO, particularly, of course, Article 65, but I'm quite sure revised versions of the three core documents being the charging policies and procedure, TIMS and the monitoring strategy. On that point, you just asked me if I could clarify. I believe that's a reference to Article 65.5, 7, rather, in terms of implementation TIMS and the monitoring strategy. I think it's probably best for me to just say this, that that is one of the provisions of Article 65 that is being reviewed and will be discussed with the boroughs at that next meeting. So it's probably not a productive use of time now to say more on it, but we're happy to consider alternative words if the boroughs will be more comfortable with those. There was one other point, I think. So did you want to come back to me on that before I carried on?
I was just going to say, you talked about these three documents, the core documents as well as the DCO. There was a suggestion from the boroughs as to whether three might become two, or the issue of whether consolidation might be beneficial. But I don't say that should be done, but presumably maybe it is a matter that would be thought about if one is introducing environmental matters into a document previously called traffic implementation monitoring. But I say that's just a matter that has been floated by the boroughs, and I say it's not one that we would oppose if that was something that was thought to be beneficial.
Robbie Owen, thank you, sir. That's understood. Yes, we will, of course, consider that as well. We're all for greater simplicity if we can achieve that.
Paper chases.
Yes, I recognise the point made by Mrs. Smith about not having to scurry around to new documents, and I sympathise with that. So we will certainly look at that. I think the only other point that I can usually deal with now is just to correct something that was said in terms of monitoring locations. Of course, I'm far from an expert on this, but I can see that actually the locations for monitoring are currently dealt with not in the document 711, the charging policies and procedures document, but it's actually in the monitoring strategy, REP 1-121, Section 3 says that the detailed initial monitoring plan for the first year of monitoring based on the assessed case is included in Appendix A. And Appendix A sets out at quite some length the initial traffic monitoring plan. It is only the initial plan, sets out locations for monitoring, including some tweaks in that respect made at previous deadlines. So that is where it currently is.
Well, thank you. That's very helpful.
Yes, and it also does say in paragraph 3.3.3 that proposals for changes to monitoring locations can be made by STIG. But I think clearly that's on page 30 of that document. Clearly this will be a matter that will be discussed on an ongoing basis as part of the continuing discussions on STIG and the other documents. So unless you'd like to hear from one of our colleagues on monitoring locations
I don't think so, no. I mean, I say clearly you have heard the requests for wider monitoring locations than are currently specified during the course of the last 2 days. So I would assume that these are matters that then would go into the discussions that you're proposing to have.
That would be right, sir, yes.
Well, I think that's a very useful point at which to consider a break before we move on to, in a sense, the more detailed provisions of the DCO that I think will occupy us for, well, I won't say much of the rest of the day, but for as long as is necessary. We'll adjourn now until 20 past 12. I think that's 12, isn't it? Well, we haven't got that far yet. No. Still got points on the rest of the...